All right. Well, since we already covered the entire introduction and most of the content, and I've said everything that I know about maps, and I've said everything that I know about GPS devices in the intro, I think that's a wrap, unless we have any questions. People say that it is very loud, so you can probably crank it down. Although, maybe you guys just turned it up a little bit. So, want to talk about maps and different devices. About a month ago, feels like it was longer, posted a video on YouTube that talked about a bunch of different pieces of mapping equipment. Phones, GPS devices, paper maps, compasses, navigation boards, and things like that. I forgot there's gonna be something else in here. When I edit the podcast version of this at home tonight, I'm gonna cut a bunch of stuff out. So the main thing we wanna do with this particular stream is sort of questions and answers from people that have specific land navigation or mapping questions based on the video there. So one of the things that we've got here are paper maps. I'm gonna talk a little bit about how you actually buy paper maps, what some of the better sources are for those. And this one here is a chunk of Tennessee. And you can tell various things about the map that you have by looking at the legend on the side. If you want to navigate using protractors properly, you need to know the scale of your map. And most of the USGS topo maps are 1:24 scale. And most of the protractors go with those, but there's obviously different sizes of things. There's obviously different sizes of maps, different scales of maps, different sizes of protractors for that. Now, one of the things that a lot of folks have asked about in the other video is why is there no easy way to do this? There is an easy way to do this. The easy way to do this is just to have a GPS device or to have offline maps on your phone. That's something that you can definitely do. And that makes it about as easy as it's going to get. But it sort of depends on what it is that you're trying to do. If you are actually trying to do really complicated stuff, like let me open up some of the questions that I have on the Gray Man Network. I'm getting questions now from you guys watching the YouTube stream. I'm getting questions on the Gray Man server, and then I'm getting questions from my customer service guys. One of them knows way more about LandNav than I do. I'm not sure why he's not doing this podcast live stream here. But people are asking really complicated questions in the Gray Man server, like how to effectively communicate your LandNav plan over voice comms. And the answer for that is it's actually very, very difficult. One of the best things that you can do if you have a team of people is to make sure everybody's on the same page with your LandNav plan in person when you can actually look at and point at maps and make decisions about where you're going to do stuff ahead of time, because being on the radio with people and saying, so what can you see from the top of your hill? That's a very long conversation that generally doesn't bear a whole lot of fruit. And that's a lot of radio communication, actually. When you're doing first responder stuff, when you're doing search and rescue stuff, a huge amount of the communication over radio is, where are you? I don't know where I am. I'm calling to ask you where I am. All right, what can you see? And then everybody opens up the maps and they're like, is there a valley in front of you? Is there a river in front of you? When was the last time that you saw a river, etc.? That's part of the reason that everybody really likes the possibilities that are opened up by a program like ATAC, because you can actually see on a map where people are without having to communicate that information via voice. GeoID type stuff should really be sent digitally. It's just a lot more efficient that way than having people try to explain, like, I think I see mostly pine trees ahead of me. It's like, all right, we're gonna have a long conversation now over the radio about where we think people might be. People are asking a lot of questions about ATAC-related stuff, because it's a very cool technology in which the military uses, so everybody wants to use the cool technology that the military uses. Best ways to do that are just get it and start playing with it. It's very easy to get now because it is on the Google Play Store. You don't have to download and sideload apps, and then you can just run it on your phone. And then you need to start figuring out which map sources you're going to use, where you're going to download stuff from. But one of the things that you do once you get into ATAC, once you have all of your stuff loaded in there, you realize that it's meant to connect to communication technology, because even though it's great for loading maps, the real purpose of ATAC is a communication tool to give that common operational picture to various people who are working together as a team so that they can see where each other are on a map without having to have that long, boring radio communication back and forth about whether or not they've hit this particular bend of the river or not. And you can actually drop points into the map and say, I want us to rally at this point. I want us to go to that point. I read a fascinating story not very long ago about, I forget the name of the aircraft now, but it was the only F-117 that has been shot down, the only American stealth fighter that we have lost. It was shot down and the pilot bailed out and was behind enemy lines. And he had a GPS device and he had an unencrypted radio and he was able to talk to the recovery guys. And one of the really important things that they had developed ahead of time was, because his radio was unsecured and everything that he was saying to the rescue team was in the clear and being listened to by the bad guys, he couldn't call out any particular location marks. He couldn't say, I'm on the top of a very tall hill and beneath me is a river that looks like such and such, because if he were to call that out, the enemy would get to him before the rescue team. So what they had done prior to his mission is lay out specific rally points, or rather not rally points, reference points, so that he was able to say, I'm 2 miles south of this point. And nobody on the opposing side was able to know where that point was. They were not able to use that as a reference point. So that kind of pre-mission coordination is really important, so that he was able to give very short, precise bits of information about his location using a GPS device to figure out where he actually was. He was able to call that out in a way that was not only short and precise, not only very brief, but it was also something that was relatively secure, actually very secure, because the enemy had no idea where point such and such was on a map. It was a virtual point selected, not based on actual geographic features. So I see people talking about using ATAC 0% for land nav, 99% for communicating points. Yes, exactly. There's no ATAC for iOS. Yes, that is correct. Nine Hole Review says, I'm talking about Owen Wilson. Yeah, Owen Wilson. That's exactly right. That was really him. Wow. I had no idea Henry would make that reference. So one of the things that is really important is coordinating this stuff ahead of time. Now, the good news is, if you're doing more civilian-y type stuff, and you're operating with guys who know the rough area, you will have specific points of reference for things that you can call out. You don't necessarily have to set those up ahead of the mission in conjunction with the mission. You can say, hey, we're going to meet over here by this thing that we did last year. You'll start to have these library of different locations and points in common that you know about, or you'll know certain things about specific areas. So generally speaking, you guys are already doing this. You guys are saying, hey, let's meet up at the grocery store and pick up the various illegal supplies that we need, all of the illegal snacks that we're going to smuggle into the theater to eat while we watch Dune. You guys can set up rally points like that really easily without complicated GIS software, because you guys already know where that stuff is. And that's one of the advantages that defending armies often have, is that they have people who know the terrain that they are defending. So that's one of the things that you see come into play, particularly in the olden days. You see a bunch of folks who already know terrain, they already know various things, and it's easier for them to not only navigate, but easier for them to communicate where they should actually gather, rally, where they should actually move to, etc. What is the code word for the T-Rex Arms shipping facility? We really should come up with better, cooler sounding code words. Like right now, we're just using alphanumeric. Well, no, we're not. We're just using numeric codes. They're not super cool. Should come up with something better. Black Site 2. Black Site 2. Site B. Yeah. Where to buy solid maps like the one you have there for various states and counties? And what's the best protection for map for rain? Okay, these are good questions. I will say, while we're working on that issue, speaking of audio podcasting, I've had a bunch of questions from the last The last couple of audio podcasts, a couple weeks ago, talked about Alec Baldwin. Did not actually talk about the armor on the set. And there's a couple of reasons for that. The one was I really wanted to focus on Alec Baldwin himself being a responsible person, both in the fact that he was the guy who was holding the handgun, who pulled the trigger that killed the cinematographer, but also because he's the producer on the set, creating the environment on the set where safety issues were being ignored. There are definitely some other people on that set who bear some level of responsibility. The first AD is somebody who is supposed to check firearms as well as the armor. But I didn't really talk about the armor simply because I wanted to focus on, like I said, Alec Baldwin, the guy who pulled the trigger, but the guy who is also the producer on the film and bears ultimate responsibility for some of the stuff that was going on there, a lot of the stuff that was going on there. But one of the interesting things about the cinematographer that came out recently was, I believe this was her second film, her first film that she was working on earlier, also a number of safety complaints made against her. And one of those complaints actually came from Nicolas Cage. Nicolas Cage actually left the set one day because of the dangerous way that she was handling firearms, or the unsafe way in which she was giving firearms to actors. So that is pretty much fascinating thing. I would say if Nicolas Cage tells you that you need to be more safe, you should probably sit down and really, you know, rethink your life, because that is not something that I ever thought that I would read, that Nicolas Cage walked off of a film set because of a safety issue related to guns. Extremely unlikely. So how are we coming on that audio, guys? Should we go back to map talk, or should we do this? I can just describe this stuff, but it's easier to actually show it in the same way that it's easier to actually show maps to people. Let's try it, see what happens. Okay, so apparently there's no way to make that work. So I'll just have to tell you how awesome it is. Basically, mytopo.com is a place that sells not only your standard USGS quad sheet, so you can buy exactly what this is. You can buy maps that are the standard US topo maps, or you can make your own custom maps. So one of the things that I would recommend that you do is you just kind of tinker on that website. Once you go in to the website, there's a place where you can pick the state, the particular state that you're looking for maps in. You can search for a specific location. But let me just see what the actual cost of it is. The other place that you can buy US topo maps from, you can buy directly from the USGS store, which is usgs.gov. And the cost of a paper map this size is $8, and then I forget what shipping is. The downside to that is, A, you're giving money directly to the United States government, which, I mean, I feel like they're already getting plenty. Then the other issue is that that is on regular paper. And one of the advantages of the MyTopo setup is that you can specify different types of materials to print your maps on. So they have a waterproof Tyvek. Let me just see what this is. So it's double the cost. It's double the cost of the USGS one, $15. And that'll get you a map, which you can upgrade to a laminated map. They can send those to you pre-laminated. Now is when you get into a sort of bigger question of what it is that you're trying to accomplish. Because one of the things that a lot of people do is they'll take a map like this, which is very large. It folds down relatively small, but a lot of times you're going to cut down the map to your area of operation. And generally you want to laminate the map after you have cut it down. The problem is if you don't have real specific mission in mind, you're not really sure what your area of operation is. This is an issue for guys like me who I have a stack of maps for different areas where I kind of do stuff. But then there's plenty of Tennessee that I don't own maps for. We kind of went over that in the video, and that's why a GPS device that has a bunch of maps on it, or a phone that has access to a bunch of maps or has downloaded a bunch of maps, is really helpful, because you can really easily get prepared to go to a part of the country where you don't own the physical maps for. But once you have a laminated map, you're actually able to write on it with markers and clean it off later. It gives you a bunch of options in addition to being more weatherproof. But the Tyvek that mytopo.com puts these maps onto is very durable stuff. It's very hard to tear. It does hold up to rain and even being underwater extremely well. What I don't know is the best things to write on. I don't think dry erase markers work at all. They actually become permanent markers magically when you write on it. But there's probably some like grease pencils or something that you could write on Tyvek and get it off with. But I haven't tinkered with that. So it, again, depends on what it is that you are trying to do. If you want to have a completely completely flexible set of laminated maps for hundreds of miles of diameter from where you live so that you're prepared for any type of operation anywhere, that's great. But it is a relatively expensive thing to do. That many maps and that much laminating is going to be, you know, it's going to be a little bit. Let me see how much it costs to upgrade this particular MyTopo map. Begin checkout. Well, it's wanting to ask me a bunch of questions as if I'm actually doing business with them, which I'll ignore. You can very easily go there and upgrade your map. Now, here is a very cool thing that you could do with MyTopo. You can actually customize, you can build a custom map. You can either customize an existing US topo map by making it smaller, for example. You can save a little bit of money by printing it out on a smaller piece of paper, either a chunk of it or a different scale of it. But the other thing that you can do is you can begin to build a completely custom map, something where you are overlaying topographical lines on top of a satellite image. There's a whole bunch of things that you can do with this service. And I wish I had some of those custom maps here because the possibilities, as they say, are limitless. You can print a whole bunch of different sizes of things, you can print on different materials, and you can combine a whole bunch of different map sources together. So I would recommend that you spend some time on MyTopo experimenting with what you can do. Now, if you are actually going to be doing your standard garden variety land nav the U.S. military way, I would stick to the map zooms that actually correspond with your other navigation equipment so that you can, you know, actually do the land nav stuff. But I would say that experiment, because you can do all kinds of different stuff with there. The MyTopo maps are hard to fold. They don't want to crease. I have found that you just push on them harder and put them into a smaller pouch, and then they kind of work. And generally speaking, it works. $16 for outdoor map, $36 for laminated map. You can laminate maps yourself, especially if you're going to cut them down. You should laminate them yourself. A bunch of people here are throwing out very specific military application questions, which I actually don't know the answer. And then people are throwing out questions that I can sort of guess what the answer is. For example, someone has said here, military crest of a hill is worth explaining. I don't know exactly what the official way to describe this is, this particular idea, but if you walk along the very top of a hill, the very ridge of a hill, you appear as a very easy to see silhouette from either side. And so the best thing to do is to not walk on the very peak of the hill, but just down the side a little bit so that you are not poking your head over. Now, it could be that you don't know whether the enemy is on this side or that side. You could be on the side of the hill that the enemy is on, but you're not silhouetting yourself against the sky. You're not making it super obvious to see you, even if you're on the same side of the hill as them and you're down below the top of that hill. And if you're walking along on one side of the ridge, you can come up just enough to sort of look the top of your head over without creating a gigantic silhouette. That's pretty important. Again, I'm not sure that I described that using the official military nomenclature or vocabulary, or I don't even know what the official nomenclature is for nomenclature. Navigating with non-standard navigation aids. This is pretty important. So you are very likely to find yourself in a situation where you don't have the proper tools, if you're anything like me. Part of this is Murphy's Law. Part of this is laziness on my part. But for the most part, I find myself in situations where I don't have the map that I should, or I don't have the compass that I should. I've started to carry this Suntu compass in my pocket. I carry a lot more equipment in the fall and the winter than I do during the summer, just because I have a jacket with way more pockets in it. And this stuff just kind of goes with me. But you got to be able to adapt and figure some stuff out. So a couple weeks ago, my family were going for a hike, and we were going for a hike in a park that had pre-organized trails, and they had little maps at the beginning of each of the trails so that you could actually see how far it was and which turns you were going to make. And I should have taken that opportunity to talk to my kids about reading maps. I should have taken a picture of that map with my phone so that I had a better idea of where the trails actually went so that we could pick shortcuts and stuff like that. That is exactly the sort of pre-planning that you can do. But we started our hike, and then halfway through the kids were tired and we were looking for something a little more exciting than walking. And so I got out my phone and I opened up Google Maps, and we were kind of guessing where the shortcuts would be. But it would have been super easy to just snap a picture of that map, even though that map didn't have any geographic coordinates on it, even though I couldn't have used my GPS to find my location on that fuzzy picture of a really simplified, stylized park trail map. That still would have been a more useful thing, because we could have looked at that map and could have said, oh, when the trail goes like this in this little S shape, we just did that back there. This kind of terrain recognition is a really important thing, because once you learn some of those skills, some of those terrain recognition skills, you're actually able to do pattern recognition on, say, really crude, simple maps, like the ones that you find at the beginning of a really, really short hiking trail. So people are asking about sextants. People are asking about rangefinders. Yeah, you can get really, really detailed here, for sure. Military crest refers to not skylining yourself but walking near the top. Yes. Get a Ziploc, fold your paper map into it, protractor, notebook, pencil. Yes, I think that it's really helpful to have a lot of these things around, not just for navigation purposes, but they just come in handy for a whole lot of different things. And again, if you ever need to stop and coordinate with somebody, just having these tools are very helpful. Topographic map or satellite style map? It kind of depends on what you were doing. So I'm sorry that our audio isn't working super well, because one of the things that would be really nice is to talk about this with some visual aids. But not having that, I'll just point out, go over to caltopo.com. Caltopo.com is my favorite free GIS source. You can subscribe for money and you get a whole bunch of extra capabilities and features. You get the ability to download offline maps onto devices. But even just the free version will let you do a whole bunch of stuff. And one of the things that it will let you do is it will let you overlay different types of map and let you compare what it is that you actually want to look at. So there's a whole bunch of layers that you can turn on. Like you can load the OpenStreetMap data as your base layer, and then you can overlay contour lines on top of it, which is essentially what you get with Osmond, the offline mapping app that I prefer to use on Android, and it also works on iOS. When you do that, you have enough data to see where roads are, where some buildings are, where, you know, various geographic features like bridges, rivers. I'm looking right now at the power lines, the railway lines, stuff like that. And then the contour lines give you your terrain data, but not in a ton of detail. And your brain has to do some of the work of translating those contour lines into your actual topography so that you can do that pattern matching. You can actually look at what you know to be a hill on the map and then look for that map in the horizon. Now, that doesn't work as well in Tennessee as you might hope, because there's always, you know, undergrowth and overgrowth and additional growth and jungle growth that you have to try to see through in order to see the horizon. It's actually been weeks since I last saw the horizon in Tennessee. Once you have that loaded into Caltopo, you can look at just a flat map with flat contour lines over it, and you can see how useful that is. It takes a fair amount of brain work to actually turn that into something that's really useful. But one of the advantages of that is a really simple system of vector-based map and vector-based topo lines, so that all of Tennessee is just a few hundred megabytes on this phone. All of Tennessee road data and all of Tennessee Wikipedia data and all of Tennessee points of interest, that's what they're called, and all of Tennessee hillshade and topo data, it's just a few hundred megabytes. It's less than a gigabyte for all of that. Once you want satellite data, you're now talking about a lot more data. You're talking about many, 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 many gigabytes of data, depending on the level of zoom that you actually want to download. Now you're talking about wanting to select a certain area to pre-download. You're not quite as flexible as you are when you go for that more detailed data. But that more detailed data is really useful. So if you're in CalTopo and you're following along, it's really simple to open up the various other map layers that you have. And one of my favorites is actually the, The shaded relief data lets you see a huge amount, even though it's not in color, it lets you see a huge amount of topographical data all shaded out. And it's incredibly detailed. And then you can combine that with a very detailed color satellite imagery map. And once you have that and you can switch back and forth between all these different layers, you can see what things highlight different features that you personally want to know about for whatever it is that your personal mission is. So for something that my brother Dave and I do a lot, we're very interested in knowing what the actual lay of the land and the terrain is when we are hiking, because Tennessee is a very hilly, non-mountainous jungle region. And when you're fighting your way through the Tennessee jungle, it's already relatively hard going before you come to up and down and up and down hills. And so planning your route around hills so that you're not having to go quite as much of that up and down hiking is really important. So that shaded relief map makes it really easy to anticipate where the steepest hills and where the gentlest valleys are so that you can adjust your route accordingly. And the other thing that oftentimes that shows is that shows where ground has been moved around to level off for a building area or to cover up old mine shafts or things. So a lot of times you can see things using that shaded relief map, which I believe is fed by LiDAR data. You can actually see stuff on that map that you cannot see through any of the satellite data. Satellite data is all visible light stuff. And in Tennessee, it is 99% of Tennessee just looking at the tops of trees, and you can't tell what is underneath. So I find that that shaded relief map is really, really helpful for figuring out Tennessee area. But when we were living in Texas, Texas is awfully flat where we were. And so the actual satellite data of what's out there in Texas was more useful than the shaded relief maps. So that satellite data, if you have the storage for it, if we have the capability to limit your area of operation to enough, you have enough storage space on your phone or on your computer to download all of that offline stuff for your area of operations where you know that you're going to be, that is the sort of thing that is much more useful than a paper map. It's going to show you stuff that's not on a paper map. It's going to show you stuff that is very possibly more up to date than these topo maps. And it's going to be easier for you to read than a flat topo map on a phone. I should open Osmond and just hold that up so that you can kind of see what I'm saying. Although Osmond also has a hillshade layer that you can turn on. And once you turn that on, that helps you visualize terrain a little bit better. Obviously, you can train your brain to read the clues on a map and visualize them very well, but if you're like me, the time that you have to actually teach your brain that stuff to where it's fully automatic is difficult. Wait, are we allowed to say fully automatic on YouTube? I don't think we are. Fully semi-automatically converting this data into 3D objects in your brain. That's what you got to figure out. Somebody on here is complaining about how much trouble LiDAR mapping is. I'm sure it is. I'm sure it's terrible, but, that's some of my favorite mapping data. It shows a lot of fascinating things. You guys should go download Osmond. You should go download local map data for Osmond. You guys should check out, caltopo.com and start to experiment with your areas. Figure out whether it's worth paying for the premium features, which show you different things like property boundaries, and it lets you download map data onto your mobile devices. It's a very useful tool. The reason I like Osmond is a little bit more, I'm not sure what the right word is for it. It's definitely more resilient and more robust. There's a possibility that we could have a total power outage, no cell phone, no signal. I open up CalTopo and it says, I'm sorry, it's been a month since you last connected to the CalTopo servers. Please connect to the CalTopo servers to verify that your subscription is active before it loads. There's a possibility that that would happen to me because it's not a tool that I use every single day or every single week. And something like Osmond, where it lives on your phone as a free open source app, and all the data has been downloaded by you and it doesn't expire, there's a great deal of comfort in knowing that I actually have and control that data. And it's inside of an app that I also own and control, and it's on a phone that I own and control that's been de-Googled. I'm not saying you have to de-Google your phones, but this is a de-Googled phone. I rarely turn this on, but I do generally keep it kind of sort of charged, and it has a whole bunch of useful apps and tools on here that that I use for things and stuff. Where to find topo maps for Australia? I should know this because I've actually done some hiking and some navigation in Australia, but that was a while ago, and I can't even remember the resources that I used. This is the sort of thing that you might have to look up for yourself. People are pointing out sometimes flat places are harder to navigate using terrain association because there's no terrain to go off of. This is an excellent point. This is very true. It's also worth having a compass on you for those sorts of places because in those places, it's very easy for you to lose track of which direction you're going. Even if you don't have a compass and you can pick out specific landmarks or specific terrain features to walk towards, you can keep yourself going in a generally straight line. If you don't have a compass, then what happens to you is the same thing that happens in all the cartoons, where you're walking along and then you find somebody to follow, you follow their footprints, and then you find that the person that you're following has been joined by another person, and then you follow those two people for a while, then you find that those two people have been joined by another person, then you follow those three people for a while. That's what always happens if you go hiking without a compass. Osmond shows some interesting stuff and physical features in my area. Yeah, I think it's worth looking around at your area and familiarizing yourself with the terrain that you have around you. One of the things that, again, I wish that I could bring up this HDMI feed, because one of the cool things about familiarizing yourself with terrain, sort of from the top down, is let's say you have an area like Centerville is the town closest to where I live. I'm very familiar with Centerville from a ground level perspective. I spent a lot of time walking around Centerville. It's a very small town, so it doesn't take long to have walked around it quite a bit and know most of the streets and know where most of the buildings are and know where you can see the river from and know where the hills are the steepest and stuff like that. And then once you have a really good understanding of that sort of thing and you look at it top down on either a topo map or inside of a computer, you start to notice stuff and you get a better idea of how to walk around and build an actual map out of what it is that you've experienced. I think these are really useful skills to develop just in general. And it helps you understand the area where you live. But it also helps you understand how to use maps and how to use geographical data for figuring things out. So whether you actually need to do basic land navigation and orienteering, whether you want to just have a better understanding of, like, maybe you're buying some land and you actually want to have a better sense of here's what the actual plot looks like and then I walk around on it and how far am I and where things are, it's just incredibly it's an incredibly useful skill. Dead reckoning is the worst land nav technique, but the easiest to do mentally. Yes, so dead reckoning is both the best and the worst land nav technique because it is the easiest to do on paper and in your brain, but it's the hardest to do because you just take straight lines, regardless of how tricky the terrain is to navigate. You just take a straight line up and down over the hardest hiking things. Any info on ITAC? I don't believe that there's ever going to be an ITAC. There's been plenty of opportunities for people to take the open source code and compile it on iPhones, and it hasn't happened yet. And it's becoming less likely that the iPhone App Store would actually allow it on based on some recent developments. So I would not wait for ITAC. I don't think that ITAC is coming. I'd like to be proved wrong, but I don't actually think... I don't actually think that ITAC is coming anytime soon. And I think that ITAC would probably be a little bit hobbled if it did. And one of the reasons that I recommend Android phones for certain things is not because Google is a better company than Apple. I think they're both pretty evil. Once Google said that their motto is no longer don't be evil, I think it's safe to assume that they're being evil. I think that Apple is equally evil. But one of the advantages to Android is that there's a lot more people making hardware for Android. And Android at its core is a open source operating system. You can run a de-Googled version of Android. And even if you have stock standard Android, it's much easier to sideload applications that don't come through the Google Play Store. That's really, really hard to do with the iPhone, and that means that there are very few, or rather I should say, there are much fewer opportunities for people to build really weird, kind of offbeat, out-of-the-box applications like Osmond. If they're not going to fit inside of the Apple Play Store, it makes much more sense to develop those for Android. So one of the things that I have been tinkering with and working with is Meshtastic. Meshtastic is a digital mesh networking radio system. It's data, but not voice at this point. And it uses the low raw radio modules, which were designed to be Internet of Things type things. But there's a whole bunch of development happening with small development boards. So these little digital radios run on just an incredibly low amount of power. Their transmission power is incredibly low. And they get surprisingly good range because of the very efficient digital modulation and codec that they're using to talk to one another. And it's a mesh device. So even though I'm holding two of these, if I had four of these devices, I could actually hop the message from one to the next and get even more range out of it. So those are very, very cool to mess with. And I'm bringing them up because they actually relate to this topic of mapping. One of the fascinating things, as we kind of touched on early on, a lot of the communication that you generally do over the radio, if it is geographic in nature, it's people asking, where are you? And then the person answers back, I don't know where I am. Where am I? And then this long conversation ensues about, what can you see? Can you see a river? Can you see any landmarks? And then this conversation goes back and forth. It's so much better if you have the ability to just send your GPS location over a data network, and then the person opens up ATAC and they're able to see where the person is. Or they're able to say, I want you to move to a point, and just drop the point on a map in ATAC, have that go over the Meshtastic network, pop up on the other guy's phone, and he can see exactly where he needs to go and how to navigate to it. So that's why we're talking about radio devices with this particular talk about maps and navigation equipment. So there are some other devices that do similar things. This is Gotenna Mesh. This is a, in some ways, this is a much less interesting device to me because it comes ready to use off of the shelf and it can't be changed or tweaked. It's a commercial product. So is Beartooth, which is a really similar small 900 megahertz digital mesh radio device. You connect your phones to these devices using Bluetooth, and then you send data across them. And Gotenna and Beartooth both have apps that let you send your location to other people over the network, and that's a really helpful thing for coordination. Now, neither of those apps, neither the Gotenna app or the Beartooth app, are necessarily good mapping applications. I think that each of them uses the Google Maps API to show Google Maps, so there's not a good way to do offline maps. I think there may be with the Gotenna, kind of, sort of, but it's a very cool capability, and it's part of the way there. The cool thing about the Meshtastic system is that it's all open source software, and it's running on a whole bunch of different types of development boards that you can buy now. Well, some of them you can buy now. Unfortunately, the silicon chip shortage has made it difficult for people to keep up with demand. So a lot of the Meshtastic devices are kind of hard to come by at the moment. But the software that they're running is open source, and features get added to them all the time. And then the phone apps that talk over Bluetooth to the radios are getting updated all the time. So there's all kinds of new features being added and being tweaked based on what people are looking for. And theoretically, if you wanted to build your own Meshtastic app, you could fork the app, build a whole bunch of new features in it, still talk to the same radios. So the possibilities for building on and expanding the Meshtastic user experience is definitely there. And the ability to play with hardware and squeeze even more performance out of it also definitely there. So you should check out Ham Radio Crash Course's YouTube channel. Josh has been doing a lot of experimenting with Meshtastic for the last couple of weeks in his operational environment, which is California suburbs, and he's getting 3 miles in between these devices pretty easily without really doing any crazy stuff like high gain antennas. But again, because these things are repeaters, it is very easy to attach one of these to a drone, send it up a few hundred feet, and now getting line of sight to these devices from other devices is really simple and really easy. So that is something that I'm really looking forward to tinkering with more. In fact, I really need to hurry. I've done a few tests with these. I need to do more because I really wanted to see what the actual physical range results I would get while we still had leaves on the trees. Again, Tennessee is a jungle, just a huge amount of foliage. Foliage definitely cuts into 900 megahertz radio communication. So I have about another week or two before there's no leaves on the trees. At which point, these things are gonna work amazing. These things are gonna go super far. But I need to get my testing in while there's still leaves on the trees just to figure that out. 3 miles with low power. Yes, I think these devices are 100 milliwatts, which is incredibly low. But there are ways to do 900 megahertz ISM stuff at 1 watt. So I think that is a really, really encouraging thing. Someone has pointed out that it is solar cycle 25, so HF propagation is doing really well. You ham radio guys should get out there and experiment, 20 meter, 40 meter. I need to do that too. Someone asking, have I increased my hop limit? I don't have enough nodes to increase my hop limit or actually get much value out of increasing my hop limit. But yeah, the messages will hop from one radio to another. That is really cool. I need to make a video about this once I've done a little bit more experimenting. But one of the things that I love about digital mesh radio networking is it is so much better than programming analog repeater pairs. I really dislike analog repeaters and the way that they work quite a bit. So digital mesh networking, where this device can talk to devices that are next to it or talk to repeaters at exactly the same time on exactly the same frequencies, is a huge step forward and extremely easy. And I don't have to do most of the complicated stuff because the programmers who wrote the code, they're the ones that actually have to deal with the complicated stuff. Oh, people are asking about drones on the Gray Man server. If you're gonna use drones, they're very good for throwing up repeaters, lightweight, low power repeaters like these. Most of the bulk of this thing is the 3D printed case is accommodating a very large 18650 battery. You could totally make those smaller and lighter. So someone asking about drones. What about using drones for route planning to survey ahead for recent obstacles or plan to avoid? Yes, so that's a really cool capability. Now, one downside to that is with a lot of drones, they're not necessarily rugged, they're not necessarily weatherproof. They take a little while to get up in the air, but one of the things that is really neat is once you get a drone up into the air, especially in Tennessee, where there's just really, really heavy foliage everywhere and mostly gigantic tall trees on every single square foot of Tennessee. Once you get up above the tree line, you can actually pick out geographic features a lot better. So even if you don't know exactly where you are, well, your drone also has GPS built in if you have a consumer drone. So you can probably figure out where you are using the GPS on the devices you're using to fly the drone or the drone. But you could spot terrain features really easily, and you could check to see what obstacles you have ahead. You could fly ahead and look at bridges and see if they are out. You could find a whole lot of stuff out with drones. So that's definitely a very useful tool for navigation. It's probably not something that you just necessarily have with you as your EDC. Pretty much everything that I have here goes with me in my bag. So it is not abnormal for me to think that in a situation where I had to go overland or a situation where I had to get home, I wouldn't have this stuff. Not this. This I found on the shelf over there. And these kind of navigation boards, this is from S&S Precision. We actually used to make these back in the day when we were more of a bespoke shop. And scuba navigation boards. Actually, underwater navigation is super fun. I haven't been diving in a long time, but that was one of my favorite things about diving is using compasses and counting kicks to actually navigate and figure things out and having planned out routes ahead of time. Someone asking if we have Discord. We have been kicked off of Discord, but you can look up the Gray Man Network if you Google, or better yet, if you DuckDuckGo Grayman services or the Grayman network, you can join that server. That's a better place to be. Drones make a lot of noise if you're trying to be sneaky. That is true if you're flying them very close to things. One of the things about a lot of the consumer drones is they're actually very small. They displace a pretty small amount of air. So once they're 100 feet up, they're very hard to hear, and they're relatively difficult to spot if you turn the LED lights off. So that's a thing. Once you get up beyond that, yeah. People talking about using balloons for repeaters, that's totally a thing you can do. Another thing that is incredibly cool are tethered drones. So instead of a drone with a battery, you have a drone that has a cable that comes down to like a giant car battery. That thing can stay up for hours and hours. Obviously, it can't move around a whole lot, but it is an eye in the sky that you have over your area, and it can hold drone equipment and various other things, and it can be up there for a huge amount of time. And if you control it over the cable instead of RF, it's actually very difficult to detect because it's not sending out radio waves all the time, and it's not susceptible to the kind of jamming that most anti-drone technologies use. So tethered drones, they're extremely cool. I expect to see a lot more tethered drone systems for perimeter security, for communications infrastructure, etc. People talking about encryption, people talking about drones. Be careful launching drones because I don't want to die when I hit one. I'm assuming this person is a pilot. That is a consideration. There's been a huge amount of furor over the danger that drones cause to air traffic, and I don't want to underplay that, but I will say we finally got a decent story about a drone hitting an airplane after whole airports had been shut down over suspected drone sightings when there wasn't actually any evidence of drones. We finally had a pretty decent drone strike incident, and it was a police drone, so it wasn't even a civilian drone at that point. So not saying that it's impossible for drones to damage aircraft at all, but I am saying that the danger seems a bit exaggerated at this point. Fly your drones with caution, and small aircraft pilots, just keep eyes out for drones, for sure. Someone asked, I had talked in a previous video, my original ATAC video that I made a long time ago, about making an APRS extension for Osmond. Did that ever happen, or is this still up in the air? Yes and no. It kind of sort of happened, but I also have kind of been focusing more on digital radio data transmission than analog radio transmission. So I have spent a lot less time tinkering with ham radio stuff in the last year, I would say. Although that does remind me, I need to renew my ham radio license because I intend on doing more ham radio stuff. I just have been busy and focused on other things. People also suggesting we get jetpacks. That would be great, because I feel like a lot of the weaknesses of drones would definitely go away if we just all had jetpacks. We could definitely do an awful lot of very cool stuff with jetpacks. Yes. Bunch more pilots in here. Bunch of people now arguing the dangers of drones to light aircraft, and what sissies pilots are, what dangerous maniacs drone pilots are. I'm not going to weigh in on it anymore. Someone asked about the viability of bonking a bad guy in the head with a coconut using a drone. That's an excellent question, because if movies have taught us anything, conking people on the head with coconuts is extremely effective. Often that's all that is required to make entry to a place or to sway a battle. Like, it's a very effective thing to do, especially if you're in the beginning of the third act of the movie. Then coconuts are like the ultimate weapon. So, you know, a Phantom IV could easily lift a coconut, not a green coconut, but, you know, a brown coconut, and yeah, worked great. I've seen a lot of footage of people using those Phantom-sized DJI drones dropping 40-millimeter grenades in the Middle East and various other places, and that is a pretty interesting thing. It's really hard to say how effective that is, but it's definitely a terrifying thing for the people on the ground, and it looks like extremely advanced technology for propaganda purposes. So in terms of terrorism and in terms of propaganda, that sort of thing is very effective. In terms of actual practical usefulness outside of those two spheres, I don't think that's hugely effective. Coconuts, though, Coconuts, as we have established, very effective and useful. Best brand of drone, and can you attach a thermal camera? So adding a thermal camera to a drone is amazing, but it immediately increases the price of the drone considerably. The DJI drone grips the coconut by the husk. That is correct. That's how it's able to carry it. African or European drones? I don't know about African or European drones. I was talking about Chinese drones primarily. My favorite personal drone right now is the Parrot Anafi because it's not a Chinese drone. It's made by a French company, but there is a thermal-equipped Anafi drone, which is made here in the United States. So if you would like a non-Chinese drone, if you'd like a Made in America drone, I think that your options are the Made in America Anafi or... it just slipped my mind. There is an autonomous drone, an obstacle avoiding drone that's really good at avoiding obstacles and following people for videography. And it just slipped my mind. But that's also made in the United States. Airspeed velocity of an unladen drone. These are good questions, you guys. I'm actually impressed with the chat today. DJI Mavic 2 Advanced is a great thermal drone option. There are more and more options available for thermal drones. Anafi makes one, DJI makes one, and then there's obviously commercial drone manufacturers. I need to do some more research in commercial drone manufacturers. The reason I haven't is just money. The commercial drones are already expensive for me, so the consumer drones are already very expensive for me. Going commercial or industrial gets pretty, pretty pricey. Yes?
Where do you see NavTech going in 10 years?
Well, I think nav technology in 10 years is going to be in one of two directions. Either we're going to be back to using paper maps and sextants and finding our way around on foot, or we're going to see some very interesting advances. So one of the weaknesses to all of this technology is the GPS network in general. So the way the GPS works is a huge network of geosynchronous satellites maintained by the United States government. And there's actually two channels of GPS communication. There's an unencrypted one and there's an encrypted one. And when I was a kid, the unencrypted channel was really inaccurate. You could find your location within a huge area. So it wasn't actually that useful for navigation. And the encrypted channel was very accurate, but it was only available to military technology. So there were military GPS receivers that had the decryption chips built in. And I don't actually know exactly how the technology worked, but at some point, I forget exactly the date, but at some date, the U.S. government began putting the really detailed GPS clock data into the unencrypted channel. And then unencrypted civilian GPS devices got really accurate, down to 10, 15 feet. So you could actually use it for navigating on roads and stuff. At any point, that unencrypted channel could be turned off. Now there's other satellite navigation systems. There's GLONASS, there's Galileo. I don't know a whole lot about those, but they all suffer from similar weaknesses in that they could be turned off from the ground or they could be knocked out from the air. So depending on what sort of geopolitical situations that we face, GPS receivers may not always be an option. So maybe we're going to go back to pure paper maps, compasses, and terrain recognition. On the other hand, there's also a lot of opportunities for stuff to get very cool and very interesting. People who are doing interesting stuff with digital radio networks. There's ways in which our navigation technology and our communication technology helps out a lot of these issues so that when Drew and I are going on a hike or something like that, we just have radios that work and we have devices that have really cool map data on them. And we're experienced in using these things because this is the future we're talking about, right? Like we're going to get good at this. We're going to practice. Not this Saturday because I'm busy.
Not next Saturday,
because you're busy. Then there's Black Friday. Then there's Christmas. But New Year's resolutions could be that we do this. So I feel like it's going to go in either two ways. It's either going to go super advanced and cool, and we're going to continue to trust big tech cloud services, and we're going to have sweet stuff on our iPhones and our Androids, or it's going to kind of go a slightly different way. Hopefully not all the way back to paper maps and compasses only, but I do think that we're going to need to gear down a little bit, which is a topic that I covered in last week's podcast, to plug the audio podcast. I talked a little bit about needing to gear down so that in order to maintain full capabilities and the ability to do the things that you need to do, maybe you don't use the best and the greatest, the really cutting edge stuff that is kind of fragile. You build something that is a little bit clunkier and a little bit old fashioned in some ways. Like one of the things that I feel is kind of charming about Meshtastic is it feels like using an old like DOS command line interface option. It is not nearly as cool or as polished as using some of the other devices that are out there. And yet this is something that I can control and that I can maintain and I can fix myself because it is really simple. And going back to that means that I lose out on certain features. Like I lose out on the ability to, say, tweet you my Spotify playlist while we're out in the wilderness. But what I gain is the ability to continue to communicate with Drew even when a lot of those other pieces of infrastructure have fallen apart. And at the, you know, what I lose is, you know, super cool, flashy color touchscreens. But what I get, in addition to the capability, is a very cool Blade Runner-esque 1980s hacker aesthetic, which fills me with a sense of nostalgia. So it's not all bad. The future was then. Yeah, that was the future that we should have been preparing for all along. So that's where I'm seeing this go. Definitely familiarize yourself with the older unbreakable technologies. Learn how compasses work. Buy yourself paper maps of the areas around where you live so that whether or not you're going to be there for forever, if that's the area where you are now, you can continue to walk around, hike close to where you are, and learn how to use the maps of that area. But definitely look into newer, cooler stuff. Definitely have a few pieces of non-internet-connected cloud technology with you just to have. Keep them charged up. Download offline maps for Osmond, stuff like that. Keep an eye out for Meshtastic devices. Check out ham radio crash courses videos that are dealing with Meshtastic at the moment. And I guess listen to that podcast that I mentioned, because I think that it is somewhat relevant to that question, which is an excellent closing question for the live stream. So thank you very much, Drew, for bringing that one to my attention. Kudos to the chat today. Everything was organized, relatively clean, some good Monty Python references. Well done, chat. I think this was very good. So thank you so much for watching this particular YouTube Live. Next time I do a YouTube Live, we're going to go pre-Python. We're going to do Goon Show references, which are increasingly relevant because everybody's putting Goon into all of their memes now. I don't get it. Yeah, so we're going to go full old school 1940s Goon Show. I think that'll please everybody, right, Drew? Yeah, for sure. All right. Have a great rest of the week, guys. Keep an eye out the T-Rex channel for different stuff, and we'll see you later.